Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marches, they never change anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't, lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he can fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So, if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
A high school volleyball game is underway outside Atlanta. The play is intense but friendly. Then a moment of utter horror. A senior suddenly collapses. You can actually hear the thud as she hits the hardwood floor. She lies there, lifeless, as everyone runs to her side. The teen is in full cardiac arrest. One coach performs CPR, but it's not working. It's looking grim for 17-year-old Claire Crawford. Then somebody rushes in with a defibrillator. There it is. It's in the black box. Sure enough, you can see Claire's body jolt from the electric charge. Julie Sermons is the quick-thinking school administrator who used the defibrillator.
Life started to come back in her, and it was wonderful to see.
And this is Claire today. It's a miracle. Claire says she was feeling fine during the volleyball play. Just seconds before she passed out, the ball came her way, and she gives it a good whack. But then something goes wrong. She's in distress and clutches her heart, then collapses.
Can you tell us what your symptoms were?
I had pain down my left arm, and my heart felt like it was working really hard, but I just assumed I was out of shape.
Claire's mom, Lisa, was in the stands watching the volleyball game.
We were just desperately praying. It was 4.5 minutes. I mean, it was a long time to watch them doing compressions, and definitely we thought we'd lost her.
Here's a defibrillator similar to the one that saved Claire's life.
Analyzing heart rhythm.
So it tells you everything.
Yes.
Do not touch the patient. Step by step, it will tell you exactly what to do. If it says stand clear, don't touch.
This is one teen who is truly lucky to be alive.
Claire, how are you feeling now?
Feel good. Better than before.
Heart disease is the number one killer of women in the United States. But when you're a healthy, vibrant 21-year-old, a heart attack is probably the last thing on your mind. It certainly was for Megan Johns on the eve of her college graduation.
I had a pressure in my chest, and it felt like a stack of books was on my chest resting. And then my left arm was tingling, and it felt heavy.
This seemingly healthy 21-year-old wasn't feeling like herself. But despite having recently given a class presentation on heart attack symptoms, Megan didn't call for medical help. For the next 12 hours, she went about her business, refusing to believe what her body was telling her.
I was vegan, so I didn't eat any meat or dairy. I worked out regularly. School was important to me, so I just stayed healthy, and it just didn't make any sense.
It didn't make sense to doctors immediately either. With no known family risk factors for heart disease, they surmised that a random blood clot due to birth control pills had caused the heart attack. But a series of tests at Cleveland Clinic uncovered the real culprit, a genetic biomarker called lipoprotein A, which occurs in about 1 in 500 people in the general population. Genetic markers for heart disease are rare, and according to some experts, their impact is still poorly understood.
It is a special type of cholesterol that actually increases the tendency to have heart attack and stroke by making the cholesterol sort of thick and more clot-forming.
I was relieved to find out something, to just be able to know and feel confident that I know what's wrong and I can now take care of myself.
The entire Johns family was tested for lipoprotein A, and sure enough, Megan's mom carries the same biomarker.
I have a predisposition to high cholesterol, and even though I eat healthy, it's always will be elevated unless I take medication to do something about it.
It's an easy thing to do to just know what your risk is, and then if something ever happens, you can listen to your body and know what it's telling you.
3 years post-heart attack, Megan is thriving. She does take medications to keep her cholesterol in check, and an aspirin a day to prevent blood clots. But she's exercising regularly and volunteers for the American Heart Association, where she reminds others about the warning signs and risks of heart attack. For Everyday Health, I'm Christina Fiore.
Imagine LeBron's physique with Russell Westbrook's energy and Shaq's fun-loving personality. That was Hank Gathers. And yet that description still falls short of telling you just how dynamic and beloved he was. 30 years ago today, a heart condition ended Gathers' life way too early, robbing him and his family of a future unfulfilled and basketball fans of a superstar in the making. In this E60 special feature, Jeremy Schapp examines the legacy of the former Loyola Marymount standout and shows us what his former school is doing to make sure that legacy is forever remembered.
Hank Gathers did things in 23 years that some people could live to be 100 and never experience. What an amazing short life, but a life well lived. I'm very proud that the school is honoring Hank by putting a statue up and celebrating our team for the 30-year anniversary.
In the late 1980s, Loyola Marymount emerged as perhaps the most exciting team in college hoops. Maybe the most exciting ever. And at the center of it all, there was Hank Gathers.
Kimball to Gathers.
Playing in an offense designed by head coach Paul Westhead, who'd won the NBA title with the Lakers in 1980, Gathers and his childhood best friend Bo Kimball were nearly unstoppable. As a junior in 1988-89, Hank the Bank became only the second player ever to lead Division I in both points and rebounds per game, averaging 32.7 points and 13.7 rebounds. But one part of his game in particular had room for improvement: free throws. Gathers was so ineffective at the line that as a senior, he made a change.
it. Hank Gather started shooting free throws left-handed just a couple of weeks ago.
In December 1989, as a senior, Gathers collapsed during a game against UC Santa Barbara. Diagnosed with an irregular heartbeat, he started taking medication to treat the condition. 3 games later, he returned to action and returned to form. In February 1990, his signature performance, 48 points and 13 rebounds, on the road against an LSU team led by Shaquille O'Neal.
Gathers continuing to challenge the big men as he scores the hoop and is fouled.
The Lions were on track to become the highest scoring team in D1 ever. But on March 4th, 1990, during their semifinal in the West Coast Conference Tournament.
Tonight in Los Angeles, tragedy at the WCC Tournament. Loyola Marymount senior Hank Gathers collapsed on the court. A short while later, he was pronounced dead.
The West Coast Conference canceled the remainder of the tournament. That decision meant Loyola Marymount, the regular season champion, received the conference's automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. In that first game since Gather's death, his best friend would honor him with an undying gesture of brotherhood and love.
Bo is going to take his first free throw left-handed in honor of his friend, Hank Gathers. That one looked good from the time that he left his hand.
The 11th-seeded Lions would have a magical run through the early rounds of the tournament. It ended with a loss in the Elite Eight to the eventual champions from UNLV. An autopsy determined that Gathers had died as a result of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the same condition that in 1993 would claim the life of NBA star Reggie Lewis. In the year 2000, Loyola Marymount retired Gathers' number 44. Saturday, he was recognized with a statue, which by its very nature imparts a kind of permanence to a career and a life cut far too short.
That 1990 Hank Gathers led LMU squad, which featured three players averaging more than 22 points a game, capped a run of three straight NCAA tournament appearances, the longest streak in program history. That team was also the last Lions squad to make the tourney.
All right, Bex.
I'm Andrew and I'm 15. I was 14 when I found out I had a heart condition. I was just in my room and the doctor just came in and told us. And then it was an emergency surgery after that, so it all happened quite quick. And I was quite shocked, but then obviously I can't change it, so I tried to get on with it.
I came into hospital for an open heart surgery. I felt scared, nervous, and a bit unsure what was going to happen to me. You just get worried through your head, worrying about when it's going to be and how long you'll be down there for.
I had to come out of hospital for open heart surgery twice. When I came out of hospital, I was really nervous about it all. My biggest worry would have been like if I'd died or something, getting it done.
My family said I didn't need to worry about it because I'm in good hands with all the doctors and they're there to look after you.
The thing is, I wasn't really worried about the surgery because, well, I suppose it's because I didn't want to know. I wasn't that bothered about it. I didn't like the idea of the scar. That was my main concern. I was worried about the scar, very, very worried about it. But people don't judge you based on your scars. I don't think I've changed the way I feel about my scar. I've just learned to accept it.
When you get the scars, it's like at first you don't like it because it's not like you, but then you get used to it. It's not always the nicest thing to talk about. But when you like make up all these funny stories, it is easier. But I was in a shark attack.
I think it's quite cool. It's quite good.
I think as a teenager, I was quite
laid back about my heart disorder and my pacemaker, and I've never had a negative reaction from my scars. I'm out on Saturday and I wore it like an off the shoulder and it was completely out, and I would never worry about a boy seeing it, like all of me.
I think when young people are around kind of 11, 12, 13 and they're transitioning from primary school to high school, that can be a really difficult time to have something that's different about you. A lot of young people find it really difficult to talk about their heart condition, and they find it difficult to let other people know because they worry about what other people will think and they worry about the kinds of questions they might get. So we spoke to Naomi, and Naomi found it quite hard to let other people know about her heart condition, so she opted not to be filmed on camera and we used her voice instead.
To have friends who know I have a heart condition and I can't run about that much. I can't keep up with my friends.
Having a heart condition, it can be difficult sometimes. Like, there can be times where you're thinking, I might not be able to do certain things that other kids can do. And I don't want to be the one that looks like I can't fit in with everybody else.
I've had 3 or 4 surgeries. I can't go outside with my classmates because I will go outside and sometimes when it's too cold I'll turn blue because my circulation isn't that good.
It's been hard in school coping with tiredness. They've cut my hours down.
Last year I had 58% attendance of school. I missed just about half of the school year.
I missed a lot of school because I was in the hospital. I walked into the school and the teachers looked at me like, nope, you're going back home.
When I'm worried, my heart can get all tense and it can get painful. It can get pains in your chest, you can feel sick. So the best thing to do is just obviously calm yourself down, because if you don't, it's just going to make everything a lot worse for yourself. I was trying to speak to someone, I won't keep it in, because I used to keep it in and then it used to impact on everything else, and I don't want to do that. So I've learned that if I'm worried about anything, go get advice about it instead of just sitting there.
If they want to know about my heart condition, I tell them, but I never really talk about it.
I only told my closest friends that I had a heart condition, but then as I got more confident, I started to just tell people because I thought, it's not anything to worry about. They were oh my god, that's so cool. Everybody wanted to be my friend at that point, because they wanted to be the one who knew the girl who had the heart operations and condition.
It's good to talk to people, tell them how you feel and stuff, because they can help you as well. My friends know about it. A few of my friends did actually come up and see me when I was quite ill, so that really helped as well.
I gave all the people that were supporting me quite a hard time. My mum especially, it was quite hard for her, and I didn't realise. I didn't really deal with it, I suppose. I just kind of locked all my feelings away and didn't bother. I suppose that was the easiest way to deal with it for me. I find it a lot easier to talk about it now because it's in the past, it's happened.
I think it affected my family quite a big way, but myself, I feel fine, but I doubt Mum and Dad felt fine at the time. As soon as I found out what I had, I was Googling it and all, so I quite like to know stuff about it and that, so Mum and Dad were trying to prevent me from doing that, because it probably made me scared, but it didn't really make me any worried about them.
In my sessions, I have had young people come in where they've Googled lots of different things about heart conditions. Often things aren't even related to them. So it's really important that I think as healthcare professionals and adults around these young people, that we think about what they've been looking up and what their understanding is of their condition, so that we can correct them if some of their facts are a bit wrong, or if they've just become really anxious about something that might not even relate to them.
I've just been told things, but I haven't really Googled it, to be honest, but I've heard a lot of things about it, yeah.
My mum tells me what I need to know and I'll leave it at that. Don't need to dig any deeper.
My mum was coming to appointments with me until I was maybe about 24. It was always nice to have her there because she knew everything that happened when I was younger. So it was easier for her to come because she would kind of understand what they were saying. And it's nice to have someone else there as well, because sometimes, like, there had been times when I've been a bit overwhelmed.
Every day at 2 o'clock, I have to, if I'm in school, go down to the main office and take medication and do my teeth. It's like, if I get tooth decay, then if I get anything, it could go down to my heart and then everything goes.
So part of our role as liaison nurses is to provide information to the young people on the various topics that they might find difficult to discuss, like tattoos, drugs, sex, alcohol, piercings, pregnancy. What we suggest might not always be what they want to do or are going to do. They will make their own decisions, but with the right information, hopefully they can make an informed decision.
So now that I'm coming up to 18, drinking is going to be on the cards, because but it's knowing your balance. I know that when I drink, I will get palpitations, and I know that it's going to thin my blood, and I'm going to have to be extra cautious. The doctor suggests you not to have piercings or tattoos. From my own point of view, I've always wanted a tattoo, and I've wanted more piercings. So I will speak to my doctor, see how much of a risk that is, and then take it from there.
When I was at the hospital for an appointment this year, I said, can I get my nose pierced? And he said no. And it was the day after, it was my birthday, and I just said, I'm going to go and get my nose pierced. And I've done it, but I know if it got infected, that could be quite bad because it could go in the blood. So it's just about taking care of it, really.
I've asked in the past if I'm allowed to get piercings or tattoos, but they recommended me not to, but I've got a feeling that I probably will do it eventually.
I go to the gym 5-6 times a week, and I have a personal trainer that I see twice a week. Like I said, I really don't feel like it restricts me. I just think I could do anything. That's the way I feel sometimes. I'm like, yeah, I could do that.
Didn't really change me. I'm still the same person. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I mean, I'd quite like to go into medicine, as I've went through it all in the past year, but I'm not too sure.
I either want to be a nurse in the cardiac ward or a play therapist, because I've known what it's been like and so many people helped me. I want to be able to help other people.
Yes, and it's actually very fitting. I want to be a biochemist. Like, I make the stuff that can save lives, and one day maybe find out more about myself.
Hi folks, in this video I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona, near Sholo, Arizona, that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas, that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions. And that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills. And then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean, it's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine, or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom.
People in the room that really are serious about importing or think that they're serious about importing, and I'll kind of give you my diabolical plan, and because I always have a motive, as I'm sure you've probably figured out by now. But we do, every year for the last several years, we've been taking war room members and private clients to China. I never charge to do that, nor will I ever charge to do it, because I don't want that much responsibility, because it's a big trip. What we do that's cool, this business is really evolving. Our business is really evolving. And Ryan Rowland and I are partners in Digital Marketer and a number of other businesses. And Frank's a partner in a couple of businesses with us. This year, we decided to kind of change up the way we were doing things, because what we were doing was the three of us were moving in sort of a pod, and we would go over and manage one of our businesses, and then we'd go over and manage another one, and then we'd go over and manage another one, sort of in a group. And it was sort of driving us crazy, because we're running multiple multi-million dollar businesses. It's hard to do. So we kind of split up our attention last year. So Ryan runs Digital Marketer, basically. That's his thing. Roland runs our events and consulting business and funnel optimization business. And I run our survival business and physical products business. I advise in the survival business. I don't run it. I advise in it, and I run the physical product side of our business. So in all of our businesses in the past, we've been very fortunate to bring together groups of syndicates or war rooms or whatever, of people that the most powerful people in those particular verticals. So I hope to do that with importers, only because I know it will be a more powerful group, and we've got power in some collective bargaining, collective buying, freight, cargo forwarding, and things like that. We do multiple containers a month, and we also have air cargo contracts. And one of the gentlemen I spoke with outside is in the air cargo business that flew in from Europe to kind of hang out with us this week and talk business with us, and that's all that they do. So the more that there's strength in numbers in importing, right? So the more that we can buy of a thing, the cheaper that we can get it. The more things that we can share on a container, the less risk we have to take. So in other words, we might buy six things, put them on one container, and we get to test five or six markets, versus if you're by yourself, it's not efficient to do that, right? Or we may be able to negotiate air cargo contracts that are less expensive than because everything works on volume. You know, everything works on volume. So who right now is already importing? Wow, quite a few of you guys. All right. How many of you been to China? Okay, so most of you guys are importing already. Cool. How many of you are already selling something in e-commerce, not importing, but selling enough you're thinking about importing? Okay, so most of you guys are real, which was the point of the $100, by the way. I just didn't want a bunch of snapperheads up here taking up a lot of our time. If you're a snapperhead, I'm sorry. No offense to snapperheads. I want to talk just a little bit for the people who aren't as seasoned about importing, of some of the benefits and kind of some of the rules, and then I want to talk about the trip. We will be going on a pretty extensive trip It's a lot more, it's almost as much about networking and masterminding together on that trip as the trip itself. Because if for those of you that are seasoned importers, we are going to go to Canton Fair to all three phases. You don't have to go to all three phases. Most seasoned importers are already past going to the fair. They don't go anymore, right? I still go because I get a lot of ideas at the fair and I meet with a number of people. Pardon? Oh, I thought somebody said. Canton Fair is, without doubt, I think the largest trade show in the world. It almost has to be. And it's crazy. You will have, your brain will just want, you'll want to, your head will want to explode after you've been there for a day. And anybody that, look, you got nods all over the place, right? It's like going, ooh, I can make money with this, and I can sell that, and I can put this with this, and I can do this. You know, I've been going over there for 16 years now. So I started going, we were talking outside with Boris, I started going over there when the Guangzhou airport was made out of concrete and painted blue and had no air conditioning, right? And now it's one of the most beautiful buildings in the world, right? So why should you import? Well, there's a lot of good reasons to import. If you're not even a physical product seller, like, I don't know, Russell, are you selling physical at all now? Yeah. Are you? Okay. I didn't know if you were, but if you weren't, Russell Brunson, ladies and gentlemen, the original pimp. No, the original Iowa pimp, right? There are pimps in Iowa. There's only one. Russell's the only one. But if you're not selling physical products right now and you're in the information space, you control media. So when you have a list, the first time you drop a mail to a physical product, you are going to freak out because it's going to sell so much more than the information product you tried to sell the other day. Has that been your experience? Yeah, that has been for us. I mean, we were talking about the tripwire, the physical tripwires being so much better. To the list, to the internal list, they're even better still, right? So if you control media, you probably should be selling physical products. If you're going to sell physical products, you probably should be importing if you have the means to do so. It's not nearly as complicated as people think it is. There's a lot of ways to reduce the risk, okay? And there are risks associated to importing. I bought in 10,000 fuzzy duck puppets one time. You don't drink at trade shows. There's one lesson. One of the big benefits of importing, even though China prices are rising because of labor costs, there are other places in Asia to import from. I import from South America, Asia, and India primarily. There are a lot of reasons to import other than price. Basically, the Chinese own manufacturing. They really do. Even if their prices come up more, they'll probably still keep a pretty good chokehold on it because there's just nowhere you can get stuff done as quickly or as much mass as you can there. There are other regions like Taiwan, for instance. We import mass volumes of things from Taiwan. If you want to make a whole lot of something, Taiwan is much more efficient than China, typically, and you can get a better price. If you want to import a little bit of something that's handmade, the Philippines, a lot of times, is better than China if you want a small quantity, right? If it's a hand good, like a soft good, something sewn or something crafted. India is great for metals. South America is good for things that are more tasteful, like furnishings and rattan and art and craftworks. There are different places you go, but we're going to China. So people ask me, like, how much money is it going to cost me to import? The truth is, I shouldn't tell you this because it's not good advice. The truth is, you probably could go to Canton Fair and spend $5,000 on something and get a market test, right? Now, if you're going to do that, you're probably going to want to buy something small that you can air freight in or something that you can buy a pallet or two of that you can put on the back of one of our shared containers coming in or share a container with a buddy. It doesn't have to be with my container, by the way. I don't care, right? You share it with another guy, sit around to dinner, split a load, whatever. That's the way it works. But if you can bring in I want to be in the rubber band business right now. I want to spend about $7,000 bringing in, I don't know, 7 or 8 pallets of rubber bands. So I'll be Mr. Rubber Bands, right? I'm going to be the rubber band king of the world, right? With all these wholesale rubber bands. That's only going to cost me $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to give that a good size market test. And if it works, I'll spend $20,000 on buying a container of rubber bands and I'm in, right? You can absolutely do that. Now, the downer to that is, when I do that, I'm usually going over and buying 5 or 6 or 7 lines. 2 or 3 of them work. 3 or 4 of them don't, right? So I'm willing to take that financial risk that you guys might not be willing to take. Here, the good news is about the financial risk in China, most of the time, you can liquidate a bad buy for cost and get out of it. It's not really that risky. You know, if you can go to your competitor, and if you decide, hey, this is not working for me, just go to your competitor and sell them your inventory at your cost or 10 under cost, your direct cost, and you'll get out. So the risk is not as finite as everybody thinks it is. Well, what if I buy a container of these widgets and get stuck with them? I'm in trouble. The worst experience I ever had in China, I bought a bunch of vacuum sealers. These were commercial vacuum sealers that are used by like meat processors. I bought weird stuff. And I bought them, and I was in a hurry when I bought them. I bought a whole container of them because the price was great. And I said, do you guys do 110? And the guy's like, oh, 110, 110. And I hold up the plug, and I say, you 110 plug, America. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, 110 plug, no problem. So I get them about 8 weeks later, and we plug the first one in, and it goes, poof, right? Because all the internal workings were 220, but they put a 110 plug on it. Lesson one, learn how to write a really good spec. So that's, you know, you want to write a good specification. But what happened was, so those things were selling in America for about $1,000. I bought them for about $200. So I had a whole load of them for $200 a piece. I lost, right? What I ended up doing, I sold the load to a South American company who could go in and rewire them and sell them with a 220 plug in South America and still make money. So I got back, I think I sold them for $190 or $180 a piece. So I lost $1,000 on the load. It's no big deal. So there's ways out. You know, a lot of people eBay off their soft inventory. That's a great way to get rid of stuff. But anyway, so how much money do you need? $5,000 on the bare bones minimum. I'd say $20,000 probably is more reasonable. You know, if you have an existing business, you already have sales volume, you know what you're selling, then I'd say infinite. You know, it's as much as you want to spend. If you know you're going to forecast out. The shipping time, you can have most, that's one of the good things about China. China's fast to manufacture. Most things can be made in about 20 days, right? And then they're now the time on the water is down to less than 20 days. So you're talking about 40 days from the time you have a confirmed order, it can be setting at LA, right? So, and being ready to go through customs. The you know, air freight, even better. Like all our credit card knives, every credit card knife we've sold so far, we've brought in by air. So I order them on Monday, and I get them the next Monday. So it's not nearly the cost of money and the time lag is not that bad. People ask a lot of times about payment and how orders are made. From a cash flow perspective, again, not nearly as bad as everybody thinks it is. Typically speaking, when I place an order, I place it with a 30% down payment. I pay another 30% when it's at the Chinese dock ready to ship, so I'm only 20 days away from receiving it, and I pay the balance while the shipment is on the water for release of documents. They call it a TT. So,
hey everyone, and welcome to Business Boutique. I'm so excited about today because I get to introduce you to one of my new awesome friends. Her name is Mignon Francois. Don't I just sound fancy saying that? Y'all, Mignon is incredible. She is just a light in this world and bubbling with personality. She makes me seem quiet and very low-key. She is the founder and owner of the Cupcake Collection. She has a location here in Nashville and one in New Orleans, a multi-million dollar business that she literally started from scratch. You're going to love her story and love her even more. Check this out. Hey everyone, and welcome to Business Boutique. I'm so excited because I get to hang out with my very good friend, Mignon Francois. Mignon, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Okay. I'm so excited.
I have talked you up. Ever since you did an interview here at our staff meeting, you are just this light. So for anyone that doesn't know your business and what you do, let's just start with a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I am a stay-at-home mom turned baking prodigy of some sort, where I took the last $5 that I had and I gambled on ourselves and turned that into over $10 million in the last 10 years.
Oh, is that all? Okay, okay. We're going to unpack how she did that. Don't worry. Okay, so let's back up.
Okay.
Let's back up to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You went through a really low point,
mm-hmm.
and even as you were telling your story, I so identified with that, not because I've been through something similar myself, but my mom has.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom found herself newly single at 33 with a six-month-old baby
mm-hmm.
and $64 to her name. She
mm-hmm.
had a little bit more money than you did,
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out, how do I turn this money into a life? How do I turn
mm-hmm.
this money into something that we can survive on,
mm-hmm.
besides just food this week, something beyond that?
Mm-hmm.
And she bought supplies and went and made cakes and then sold them the next day and turned that money
mm-hmm.
into what is now her bakery 35 years later.
Yeah.
So I loved your story, but let's go back to like how you got to that point
mm-hmm.
and what was going on in your head, because now you're this great success story, but at that time you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know what lied ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You've got babies. How many kids did you have at that point?
At that point I had six
kids. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you have seven now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you're broke and you're like take us back there and what that was like and what was going through your head in that moment of feeling like you're in survival mode.
Well, we had come to Nashville for a better life.
Right.
And then as soon as we got here, the job that we got here for fell through.
Mm-hmm.
Last one hired is the first one fired. But I told God when I came to Nashville, God, I want a home for my children. I'm not doing this same thing anymore. I'm not living in apartments for the rest of our lives. I want a yard for them to play and a fence and rooms that they can call their own. And so almost a year to the date, we moved out of that apartment into what would become our forever home. But it wasn't easy and it wasn't cute or simple, right?
Right.
When we got it, my husband, I was married at the time. My husband called me and he said, I found this house, this cute little neighborhood. It reminds me of New Orleans. And he brought me down there to look at the house. And I was like, this is an ugly house. And the place where you're taking me to eat today better be better than
right,
this
right.
house. And so we went and I saw the people coming out of the houses surrounding this little restaurant. And I said, take me back to that house. And we went inside and we were standing with the floorboards around our knees because we had fallen through the floors. It was condemned.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's full.
Yeah.
Oh, take it.
I love it.
And there was a sign outside that said owner financing. And I thought that meant that the owner would just give you the money. Like, I really thought they were giving the house away, but that it was just so bad that nobody
right.
really wanted it. And
right.
so we called and we were like, you know, we'll take the owner financing.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like,
not having any idea what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right, sure.
And he was like, it doesn't work like
yeah.
that. And he's like, people want this house. They want to turn it into restaurants and all kinds of stuff. I'm like, nobody's going to do that.
Right.
And so you should just take my deal. I want owner financing. I don't want to pay you for a year. I don't have any money to give you down, as a matter of fact, because I need every bit of whatever money I'm going to get to renovate this condemned property. And he was like, get your life. Goodbye.
Yeah, yeah.
But some time went by, and they actually ended up calling us back and said, hey, you know, are you still interested in a house? You mean the one that everybody's going to buy? Like
right,
all
right.
these people,
yeah,
wanna,
people lined up. Yeah, sure.
Want to put restaurants in? Yeah, we're still interested. And so he called us down to talk about working on some other houses for him in exchange for the sweat equity on this house. Now, he's not going to give us any money,
yep.
but I'm going to give you sweat equity towards the $10,000 you need to buy this house, and then then I'll own and finance it for you. But we didn't have a job.
Right.
Because last one hired is the first one fired. And so it's like, yes, we'll take it.
Yeah.
We didn't know how we were going to eat, though.
Right.
We just believed that God wasn't surprised
right.
about this, and that if this was our house, he was going to make a way. And so we showed up with our kids to start renovating that first property that they gave us to work on. And by the end of the 4 weeks that it took us to do it, he had paid us $8,000 in cash
wow.
for our family
wow.
to take care of us. When he made it clear he wasn't giving us anything.
Sure.
So it's like when you follow in obedience what God tells you to do, he's responsible for the outcome.
Mm.
And that's the thing that I've learned over the whole process of doing the Cupcake Collection. And any story that I hear all these women begin to come and tell me about how they want to start. And that has been my life's work now, Christy, to do what it is. As I believe that I want to show other women what they can do if they believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm using my mouth for. That's
yeah.
using my energy, my time, my gift, my talents for. And so it took us 4 weeks to flip that house for them. And we got the property. We moved into it. It was 2 rooms and a half bathroom. Mm-hmm. And the half bathroom was a toilet and a tub.
Mm-hmm.
My children didn't complain about the fact that we had plywood floors. I mean, they were happy that we were together. And I don't think that they knew that we were broke.
Yeah.
And that's a word that I won't even allow my children to really say,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's something that we don't really use in our family mm-hmm. because broken has nothing to do with the money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they didn't know that we were broke.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money, and our situation was dire.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I were going through a time where, you know, the economy was tanking, and one of the biggest things that makes marriages fail is finance.
That's right.
And so we didn't have any.
Yeah.
And then we didn't have much work either.
Right.
And so I prayed, and I said, God, give me something mm-hmm. that I can do to help my husband make ends meet. Because to me, he looked like death. And when you're really close to someone, as you are when you have a spouse, you can read them.
Right.
You know, like I could see it underneath his skin.
Yeah.
Like he looked like death to me. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that he wasn't dying. He was dying to me.
Mm.
That our relationship was dying,
mm-hmm.
And that God was resurrecting something new in me. And I'm not an advocate for divorce,
sure.
you know, in any kind of way, but everybody has to want to work for it, right?
Right.
And so when you find yourself in a position where after 21 years of marriage, my husband says, I want a divorce.
Mm.
And even in that, we still opened the cupcake collection together
mm-hmm.
because it was like, what do I have?
Right.
I have nothing.
Yeah.
I have taken care of your children.
Right.
My life has been you.
Right.
And our home. Now what am I supposed to do? I had a degree, you know.
Right.
And I had used my life to raise our family.
Yeah.
What about me?
Right. Right.
And so he said, I'll stay with you to open this business. Mm. And that's something most people don't know. We knew when we opened that business together that he was staying long enough to get me on
wow.
my feet.
Wow.
And so even through that, we sort of mended ourselves back together for a time, but it just,
sure.
you know, it just didn't end up working out. But what we did was I heard God say, make cupcakes. When I asked God, I was trying to help him.
Right.
I didn't know that God was going to turn around and use it to help me.
Right.
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 And so I was listening to Dave Ramsey.
Uh-huh.
Every day. I grew up in a household where we listened to NPR.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
And on the way to school every morning with our mom, we would hear the rest of the story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we would listen for the rest of the story. And I was kind of looking for something
sure.
like that when I discovered Dave Ramsey.
Sure.
And I heard the first time I stopped on the radio station, I heard them screaming, we're debt free.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I got so much joy on the inside of me. I wanted that.
Yeah, sure.
And I was like, turning up the radio, what are they saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And what are they talking about? And they were going off the air. And I was like, what was that?
Yeah.
And I was panting for some of that because my mother had raised us to be debt-free. I mean,
yeah.
she taught me financial responsibility. She taught me that the borrower was slave to the lender. And I remember having my first credit card when I was 15 and getting punished because I couldn't pay the bill out completely when the bill came in. So not only did she take my credit card, she took everything I purchased with it, and she took my paychecks until they were paid.
Wow.
So I understood what it meant
sure.
to lose my stuff, and mm-hmm. I never wanted to lose my stuff again.
Yeah.
But here we were. I was listening to him, and I was waking up every morning at 3:17. And what I want people to know is sometimes when you get up in the morning – and you think it is that you're turning off the stove or you want to check the doors. For me, I wanted to make sure my children were breathing.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
a lot of moms feel that way.
Yeah.
And I turned on the TV one morning because I couldn't go back to sleep. And Wayne Dyer was on the TV and he was saying, the morning breeze has something to tell you.
Mm.
Do not go back to sleep. And I was like, that sounds crazy.
Right.
You're getting off my TV.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's 3:00 in the morning. I'm looking for my remote. He says it again. And now I'm looking high and low.
Yeah.
And he says, God is trying to talk to you, mm. and this is the only time you'll be silent. And I was like,
well, that's true. My kids are asleep. This is the only time that it's going to be silent in my house. That's
and
valid.
I was like, I can relate to that because
yep, okay.
I know God,
gotcha.
Right? And so I sit down and listen. He says, the thing you're getting up every morning for, that's not what it is.
Mm.
And I was like, whoa, he's speaking to me. That's right.
I love it.
And so he said, you know, now that you know that you're getting up for a purpose to hear God, it's going to be hard. It took me about a week to following his instructions to put my feet on the floor and show up in my living room one morning at 3:17 with the Lord. God, I'm here. What are we doing?
Yeah.
I don't really know how to hear you. I really don't know what you sound like. And if you come in here right now, God, please don't, because I'll be
scared out of my mind. That's right.
Right. I don't want you to show up, but I really kind of want you to show
That's
up.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
And so I did what the only thing I know how to do. I saw my Bible sitting under the coffee table and I grabbed it and I opened it to wherever it would fall. And it fell on chapter 3 of this particular book. And I ran down the 17 and I got my first word from the Lord.
Wow.
And I began to search feverishly then through the Bible
right.
in every chapter 3 that there was in every verse 17. And I
wow.
would read on until it didn't apply anymore.
That's right.
Until I read the whole entire Bible that way.
Wow.
And I think it was about 6 weeks that I was, once I knew what I was getting up for, that, you know, I had seen God say, write the vision, make it plain. So I got me a journal. I started writing everything that I was reading. And he began to lay out for me all of the things he wanted me to know, that he loved me, that I was good enough, because I was broken, Christy. Like, I didn't think I was pretty. I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think that I would ever be able to finish anything because I had really great ideas, but I never would finish them.
Yep.
I would always start, but I would never finish. I've learned in the process, and God will give you so many things as you go and follow him, and you think what you're getting up every morning to actually effectively make happen is the goal, but God has something else because his ways are not our
That's
ways.
Right.
I know how to start. My ministry is not necessarily in finishing,
right.
but I learned that there was a positive spin on that I could help people get started. In that time, God gave me a plan. And then when he gave me that plan, one of the last verses that he said to me was, I listen, choose life, Mignon. I lay before you life and death, blessings, choose life. So I realized that I had a responsibility in this. This was the last thing God was going to give me.
Yeah.
This was the last idea that he was going to watch me start and not follow
yeah.
through.
Yeah.
And, you know, because even though I'm not a finisher, there's still a way not to leave it on the side
right,
of the road, right?
Right.
Just,
right.
Oh, I'm not
there's
doing that anymore.
There's a stewardship element
yeah.
to this.
Like
right.
you can package it and give it to somebody else, or you can say this, you can write about it and teach it to someone. I mean,
right.
you're not supposed to just leave things on the side of the road.
Right.
And that's kind of like how I was doing it. And I learned at 3:17 in the morning that God had chosen me for something and he was not playing with me, that this was going to be my life and I could go to the left or I could go to the right. And I decided to choose life.
Mm.
And so in choosing life, I heard Dave Ramsey say, you could have a bake sale. And I thought, you could have a bake sale every single day.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know how to bake.
Right.
Not even
minor detail. Whatever. Sure. Sure.
Right,
we're going to unpack that. Don't worry.
And he said, but you have these two little girls, and they can. But as we got started, my oldest daughter let me know, hey, Mom, I have a plan, and it really doesn't
it doesn't bother you and these cakes. Hey, I can relate to her. As my mom tried to pull me into the fold, I was like, my dreams don't involve icing. Thank you. I grew up with icing. Yeah.
And she wanted to go back to New Orleans. And so without her, my baby daughter wasn't interested. So now I got to learn how to bake.
Yeah.
We had all these culinary books in the house. My husband was passionate about baking and cooking and food because we're from New Orleans. And so he wouldn't help me. He's like, they got books in there. You know, it's like, fine. I had the secret weapon, my grandmother.
Mm.
My grandmother would be who the movie The Help would have been made about,
okay.
right?
Okay.
She left her children at home while she went to take care of another family.
Okay.
But every day there was food, and every day there was cake. And what I loved about going to my grandmother's house was eating. And I love when grandma would come because there would be food, because my mother didn't cook.
Sure.
I mean, she's a great cook, but she's not happy about it, right? And so I would snap beans with my grandmother. And God says, honor that father and that mother that your days may be long on the land. And here's what I realized. Long doesn't always mean time. Long could mean abundant, right? So that it be well with you. And so I think that God honored all the time that spent my grandma, because I love that chick. You know?
Yeah.
I hang with
you
her.
You didn't even know at that time what that was going to, how that was going to play out in your life.
I call her on the phone before unlimited long distance.
You're right, sure.
And my mom's like, look, 5 minutes. That's it. That's all I can afford to give you. And we made a deal. If you will make the food, I will wash the dishes, because I hated washing dishes. My mother hates cook. This was when I was 17, living at home in New Orleans. And I said, fine. Called my grandmother, told her what we're going to do. She's like, all right, this is what you need to get. Well, here I am. I've learned how to cook long distance with my grandmother on the phone. So 17 years later, I need to do something in the kitchen. Who am I going to call?
That's right.
I'm going to call my grandmother.
That's right.
And I said, grandma, I need to make a cake. She's like, open up your hand. Pick this much flour up. Pinch your fingers together. Measure to this first line. I mean, that's the way she told me how to do it. But standing there looking at everything my grandmother gave me on a piece of paper, I got my first successful thing that ever baked.
Yeah.
I learned God wanted to create this with me.
Mm.
While I couldn't bake well out of a box even. I mean, you just add the thing that they say.
Two eggs,
it's all
you need, oil.
It's going to come out. It doesn't come out for me.
Yeah.
And he was teaching me that I was going to have to depend on him.
Take me back to this season of the Lord is speaking to you at 3:17 in the morning. When did you get the idea? Was it the Dave Ramsey bake sale? You could have a bake sale. Was that when cupcakes entered your mind?
I don't know.
When did it turn into the cupcake idea?
I think it became cupcakes because I was trying to bake cakes, you know, and I couldn't decorate them.
Okay.
And I didn't have the skill to do that.
So let's talk about that season right there. Like, you have an idea. You're trying to do something. It's not turning out great.
Yeah.
And you need something to work for you. You need a business. You need a plan. You're trying to provide for your family. Why did you not think, oh, this isn't for me, I should do something else? What made you press through and say, I'm going to figure this thing out, I'm going to follow through, that type of thing? Like, talk me through that, because I think a lot of women watching and listening are facing challenges, and they're having trouble discerning, do I push through this challenge and find a way to make it work? Or is this just a sign I'm not cut out for this? I should actually do something different. So take me back to that, because that's difficult, I think, sometimes to know the difference.
I think for me, I really understood when I read that Bible verse, choose life, that I really thought I was going to die. You know, I thought it was over for us. And I was tired of being sick and tired.
Right.
You know, it's one thing to be sick, but then to be sick and to be tired, that's just drained. And I was drained of not having enough. I heard some rap lyrics.
Oh, let's have it. Okay. Bring it. Okay, I'm ready for this. We got Jesus and rap music. You are my kind of girl. Here we go.
I think, so I heard this song that has been touted as one of the best rap collaborations of all time. Jay-Z and Kanye West.
Okay.
The song is called Otis. And I'm listening to this rap song, and Kanye says, they ain't see me. Because last week, I was in my other bins. This time, I was in my other bins. And I'm like, hold on a second. He has options, and they're luxurious. And I don't have a car.
Right.
You know, and it's just like, why is it that Jay-Z and Beyonce and Kanye and Lil Wayne have all this abundance? Are they more loved by you, God? Like, do they have more of your favor? And I don't. And I started realizing that there was something that was required of me, and that was work.
Okay.
Because Adam and Eve, when they went into the garden, and I discovered Rabbi
Lappin
on your show. And I started following and reading his book, and I learned this concept that they probably had the best digs of all time. I mean, you can't get a better house than the one that Adam and Eve had.
Right.
But yet work was required of them. God said, go work.
It is good. That's right. The work is good.
And
right.
I think that that's what I realized, that you think that when an idea comes to you, it should just happen.
Right.
But overnight success takes 10 years.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that it takes 10 years, because you got to learn all of the pieces, and you got to get humble. You got to be grateful for where it is that you've been in order to get more.
Yeah.
And it takes time for that revolution to happen.
Yeah.
And I learned that work was required of me, and I had to do the work.
Okay, so I think this is huge. I want to camp here for a second, because I think it's incredible that you can look at someone that is a famous, a celebrity, rich, name all the things.
Mm-hmm.
But let's even take a different example. Let's say it's not Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's someone in your neighborhood and they're wealthy and
they
have a lot of money. I think a lot of people would look at that, whether it's Jay-Z or someone in your neighborhood that drives a Benz or whatever, and they would think, well, they just got a lucky break. Well, they have all this help. Well, they have it's family money. And what's amazing to me is you saw that as personal responsibility to respond to the opportunity, to do the work that would be required to reap the fruit that you wanted in your life, where so many people are stuck, and they've been stuck, Mignon, for 5, 10, 30 years. Like, well, I don't know why I'm stuck. Well, everybody else just has it easy. Everybody else fill in the blank. And they take a victim mentality. And if you have a victim mentality, you will get victim results.
Exactly.
And I love that you saw this. And someone as elevated as Beyonce and Jay-Z, which are so removed from you and I in real life, and you didn't see that as, well, of course, they're famous, they're rich, all the things that would be true, they got 16 nannies, whatever. Like, if I had that, that would be so easy to say, but instead you thought, no, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do some work required. You know, this is funny. This is a random sidebar here, but recently I put a thing on Instagram, actually about Beyonce and how much she practiced and worked. Like, she rehearsed
8 hours.
Eight months for two hours. And there were a lot of people like, oh, that's so encouraging. And there were a couple of people like, well, yes, she has lots of help and she's not a great example. And I'm like, there's anybody that you can find fault with or you can learn from.
Yeah.
And there are people that you can pull their work ethic. You can, you know, if someone's rocking it at their marriage, I want to go learn from them. And I mean, they're perfect and everything.
Yeah.
I may not go to Beyonce to teach me about Jesus. That's fine. But I can learn from her work ethic, right? Like, you can learn something from everyone. If someone's rocking it in an area of their life in business, I'm going to go learn business from those people that are rocking it. And I just love that that was your takeaway.
Yeah.
I just want to commend you. Like, that is... that was your takeaway in that moment where it would have been so easy to be like, well, that's them, not that's not me.
Yeah.
You
well, here, here's one of the things that I know is that Jesus taught in parables because they were relatable.
Right.
That you could remember a story. And so that's why it works to tell my story or to tell other people your story, because they can see themselves in it.
Right.
Well, here's the aha moment I had the other day.
Okay.
Rap songs are modern day parables.
Mm.
It's just who is delivering it.
Right.
What is the message?
Right.
Because God can use a donkey.
That's right.
To
that's
speak
right.
to you.
That's right. And he has.
And he has.
Right.
And he will. And so it's like, what are you listening to?
Mm.
My mother told us that we were great. I mean, she was the biggest cheerleader. So I think that I always had this greatness living on the inside of me. And when I was a little girl, I knew I was going to be famous. Like, I don't want that to sound arrogant or anything, but, like, I always knew I was going to be famous. I didn't know what it was going to be for. But this is why. Because I believe that God didn't waste my fabulous name on nobody
that
knowing
that is
it.
A fact. That name needs to be in lights. It's a great name.
I was like, this is a fabulous name, and people need to know it. So I have to do my due diligence to make my name great.
Yeah.
So all of that was living on the inside of me. And yeah, I didn't just have the example of Beyonce, because remember, I told you about a condemned house that I moved
right,
in.
Right.
But it was in an affluent neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody that was rich was buying up all these properties that people in my community couldn't afford to buy.
Right.
And I was like one of the few that happened to have this blessing fall upon me. God says,
said owner financing is free. I mean, no one else knew that that's what that meant. You took advantage of that opportunity.
But God said, I will open you a window of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there will not be room for you to receive it. I believe that. And here's the thing. If God is a man that he could not lie, then if we know what the promises are, all we have to do is repeat them back to him. It's just like with your kids. Mommy, you said, Mommy.
Oh, they'll tell you what you said.
Oh, yeah, they
Carter
will
not let me forget what I said.
But we don't do that to God.
Right, right.
God has told us certain things.
Yeah.
And it's science. It will work for you if you apply it.
Yeah.
And I just got it in my heart. My neighbor across the street was a huge supporter of me. She lived in this big, gigantic mansion, just two of them, her and her husband.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, I got all my kids over here.
Right.
We don't have running water half the time. We don't have electricity some of the time. And my kids never went around saying, we don't have anything.
Right, right.
There were many days that they went to school and they had to eat breakfast and lunch at school because our dinner is not sure. We're going to eat, but we were what is more commonly known in Middle Tennessee as the food insecure, meaning that you're going to eat, but you're not sure what,
right.
You're not sure what time. There were many days we ate at 10 o'clock at night because that's when something was killed to, bring home to eat. But they never complained about that. And I feel like I learned at 3:17 in the morning that your reward is based on how you go through the problem.
That's good.
Your provision
is
based on the way that you travel through the problem. I didn't want the poor me award.
Yeah. Even your attitude with the plywood floors. Like, you're, like that. I love that you're talking about that because that matters. I think a lot of people in business or in life, they are in a season of difficulty, small beginnings, unimpressive starts, and they're like, poor me.
Yeah.
I only have 200 followers. Poor me. It's like, if you're not faithful with the 200, God's not going to give you 2 million. So it's like, if you don't have the right heart, the right spirit, the right gratitude, the right humility, the right work ethic with the 200 followers, with your humble beginnings, with your unimpressive, terrible first keynote that you ever did, or your first product, your first cake that just sucked and no one wanted to eat, if you're not faithful with that, he's not going to give you more to be ungrateful and unhappy and joyless about. So I just love your attitude and your spirit through all this, because there's such important lessons. I think so often in business we think, oh, I just need the business steps.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you need the character.
Yeah.
You need the steps, but you need the character to carry you through those steps first. And I just love these takeaways that you're like, I didn't want the poor award. I didn't want that mindset.
Because I heard God say at 3:17 in the morning that when you're fasting, I took it from that Bible verse. When you're fasting, don't go around telling people and walking around with a long face. And I thought that probably applies to everything else that you're going through. Like, don't walk around saying, oh,
I'm so pitiful.
Like, everybody has their own challenges. You don't know what those are. But if you can be grateful for where you are, like, you can't get more until you're grateful
for what biblical. It is that you have. That's right.
And so I think that was the thing that changed my life, because I think I was bitter.
Yeah.
I was a bitter woman, but I learned, I learned this wonderful lesson. As I've been able to go around and speak to people, doors have been open for me. And Dr. Jackson taught me this wonderful concept that none of us know our first name.
What do you mean by that?
And so it's like this, you know, hi, I'm Mignon.
Uh-huh, Christy, nice to meet you.
Hi, Christy. But if you were to say it in a sentence, how would you say it to me? If you're going to introduce yourself to me and I said, hi, I'm Mignon.
Hey, I'm Christy Wright.
Nice I'm Christy Wright. Nice to meet you. There's something similar about my name and your name. We both did the same thing. When I stuck my hand out to introduce you, you said the same thing that I said. And so I learned that on the day that I was born, my parents gave me a gift. That was my name. And that's because they wanted me to individually be recognized as I went throughout the world. And sometimes we're arrogant to believe that we place those names on our children when, in fact, those are funneled to us from the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bible, we see all these examples where God told people to name their children things, and they knew that those names came from the Lord. But now we're so far removed from God that we don't realize that God is still telling us what to name our children.
Yeah.
Otherwise, all Kimberlys wouldn't act the same.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And so my parents gave me a name because they wanted me to know who I was and to stand out as an individual. And then they gave me something else. They gave me their name so that I would know whose I was.
That's right.
So when I went into the street, if there was another Mignon, they would be distinguished that this is my Mignon. This is the family that I come from, so that I would know whose I was.
Mm-hmm.
But God also gave me something on the day that I was born. He gave me his name.
Mm-hmm.
so that I would know that he would never leave me, that he would always be with me, and that is, I am.
I love that.
The word of God says, who do men say that I am? We're all these, he's all these people.
Yeah.
He's living on the inside of all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a Bible verse that says, tell them that I am sent you. And so when I say I am, I put on the first part of my name.
Oh, I love
that. So
that
I know that all things are possible for me.
That's right.
And when I think about the word impossible, it's just a contraction that says I am possible.
That's right.
That means that there's nothing that's impossible with God.
I love that.
And so God is always with you. He will never leave you or forsake you. And he's given you that promise to carry with you everywhere you go, even when you just speak your name.
Yeah, that's I've never heard it put that way. That's beautiful. Yeah. I love it. I love, because I think so often, Christine Kane talks about this, but so often we understand intellectually God is the creator of the universe and anything is possible with him, and we completely disconnect ourselves from that as that lives in us. That lives in us all day, every day, that power, that spirit. And so I just love, I am. I love it. I'll never introduce myself the same way again. You know, I love it. Okay, before we wrap up, I want to talk specifically about belief, because we're talking about that in this show. And this is one of those things, even as you tell your story, like you believed. Maybe you didn't believe in yourself every single second. Maybe you didn't believe in your circumstances, but you always believed in a hope for the future, this idea of choosing life. And I think that when you're in a hopeless situation, when your house is condemned, you're falling through the floors, you don't know how to bake out of a box, and the box that you did bake was not good, you got $5 to your name, like, how do you believe and how do you maintain belief? What keeps you anchored when you're going through those seasons where you don't have any proof around you that the future is good, that God does have a plan for you, that you don't have any signs or indications of how it's going to work out, you know, where you're standing in front of the Red Sea and God has brought you to this impossible place.
Yeah.
How do you have that faith that carries you through? Let's
I've
talk about that.
I've seen him do it. You know, I always love to teach about this. There is a Bible verse, Hebrews 11:1, says that now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And what I love about that is one day I was sitting reading the Bible. Like, you have to know the promises in order to apply them. Like, you know, when you get in your car, you believe that it's going to start.
Right.
You know, I believe that when I go and turn on the light switch, the lights are going to come on. These are things I believe because I've seen them happen. I've seen God perform in my life. I've also seen him perform in other people's lives. And I was like, God, what makes them better than me that you should give them more than you've given me? But I've got 7 children. I know I can't treat them all the same.
Right.
So the Bible says, according to your faith, be it unto you.
Wow.
So the same thing goes for people. You know, mothers could understand this. I can't treat Johnny the way that I treat Ashley, because Ashley wants to stay after school. She wants to be on the cheerleading squad. She wants to join, you know, the 4-H club. She wants to do all this stuff. So I've got to change my schedule around, do all this stuff for Ashley, because this is what Ashley has worked on. Whereas Johnny just says, Mom, can you make sure that I have snacks because I'm going home?
Right.
Right?
Right.
And all I have to do is make sure that there's a roof over Johnny's head, and Johnny is set and he's over here.
Thank God we all have some Johnnies in the family, right? Like, it's like, mamas are tired. We need a Johnny here and there. That's my Carter. Yeah.
But it's according to Ashley's faith.
That's right.
That as her mom, I have to show up for her.
That's right.
And do the things that she needs me to do as her mother.
That's good.
And I think that that's the way that God is. God says, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and does what? Opens it.
That's right.
Like, the door is not going to be open for you. You must open the door.
Right.
So work is required of us. And I think that that's what I realized, that it wasn't that they were more special than I was. It wasn't that they got a lucky break. It was like, what is the work that they put in? I started asking people, what did you do to get here? I began interviewing people like, why is it that you're here? Yeah. What did you do? And I started realizing some of the most successful and wealthy people came from some of the lowest.
I was going to say, I would be willing to bet that when you interviewed these successful, wealthy people, none of them said, I don't know. it was an accident.
Yeah.
I just woke up here one day on the mountain. No one said that, right? No one said it happened overnight.
Yeah.
It was easy. It was fast. And it was accidental.
Yeah.
No one said that. And we have this myth, because what's amazing is when we completely remove successful people from the work required that got mm-hmm. them there, then it gives us an out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's out of your control, then it's out of my control.
Mm-hmm.
Poor me. I can just
yeah.
sit here and feel sorry for myself. But when you start to see, we live in a world where you reap what you sow.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the parable of the talents. When
mm-hmm.
you are faithful with a few things, you will be entrusted with many things. And
mm-hmm.
so I love that, because even as you did research, you start to see there's a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And God is a God of patterns.
Yeah.
Like, you start to see
yeah.
this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, work is required.
Yeah.
Dave Ramsey tells a great story that I love. I'm probably going to mess it up, but it's kind of a parable story about how a wealthy man was walking along a road, and he passed this beautiful farm. Like,
mm-hmm.
imagine a plantation with perfectly manicured fields and the landscaping, and the house was painted, the fence, so everything was immaculate.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmer was out working the field, and the businessman came along, and he said, "Oh, wow, farmer, God has blessed you.
Mm-hmm.
God has blessed you with this beautiful, immaculate farm." And the farmer said, "Yes, he has, and you should have seen what it looked like when he had it to himself." In that, it's like, it's us and God.
Yes.
It's like, God will bless you and
right.
work the field.
Mm-hmm. Hebrews 11:1 says, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." So if you want things, if you want to activate the heart of God, you got to get on his level.
Yeah.
Because God emptied out heaven for you that you might have life more abundantly, or to the full.
Right.
And so if God emptied out heaven for you and you expect to do mediocre things, but then you want God to give you
right,
great and amazing
right.
blessings, it doesn't work that way.
Yep.
But when you activate now faith, you become on the same level of what he invested. Now faith is not having any evidence that what I believe is going to work. Now faith doesn't test it. Now faith doesn't know that when I get in my car, I'm going to turn this thing and it's going to start up and it's going to go. I've seen it happen.
That's right.
Faith will allow you to believe in something that you've seen happen before,
yeah.
but now faith doesn't give you any warning.
Mm-hmm.
Now faith just says, "Hey, I believe that this will work, so I'm going to start doing it right now."
Yeah.
When you activate your now, you activate all you own, which puts you in line with what God said, "I invested in you."
Yeah.
"I invested everything in you." So now you're investing everything in God, because you're giving him back all that you have, and all that you have is right now. You don't wait to say, "Well, God, I'm going to wait until you give me the money."
Right.
"I'm going to wait until I graduate from college. I'm going to wait until my children grow.
I'm going to wait
until
I'm ready."
Yeah. There's a study that's 98% or 95% of Americans are waiting for some big major event to happen before they start living. But this says, "I will live right
that's
now."
Right.
And when you O-W-N, you're N-O-W, what happens? You W-O-N.
Mm.
And that's what I realized. Mm-hmm. It was about perspective. That when I activate everything I got, God says, "Okay, now you're serious."
Mm-hmm.
"Because I was serious about you, so I gave you everything I had. So give me everything, and then you can start asking me for more." I think that God wants to do more stuff. He wants to give us more stuff.
Right.
But you know what we keep asking him for? Simple things that he's like, "I'm not doing that for
yeah.
you. I gave you the ability to tie your shoes," just like the farmer.
Right.
You know, you can you
right.
imagine what it looked like when
right.
he when
right.
he
right.
had
right.
it by himself?
Right.
Like, he gave you the opportunity. He gave you your hands. He gave you a mind. He gave you vision to be able to work something. That's why where there's no vision, people perish,
because
you can't see
yep.
where you're going. You don't
there's
know.
There's no hope. There's no
what
yep.
to do with it.
Yeah.
But God gave you the ability to tie your shoes, so you don't get to ask him, "God, can you tie these shoes for me?"
Yeah.
He's like, "No, I'm not doing that."
That's right.
Ask me for something
that's
more.
That's right. Try again. I love this theme of how we've even come full circle to faith, because even I did Devo for our company where we do devotional once a week. And in January, a couple years ago, I did this. And I was teaching from Matthew, and I'd never seen this correlation. I'd always seen a cause and effect in Scripture of, because of your faith,
mm-hmm.
you've been healed. Because
mm-hmm.
of your faith, I will bless you. Because of your faith, because of your faith.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrews, the whole chapter of 11
yeah.
is by faith, by faith, by
yeah.
faith, Sarah, by faith, Abram, by faith, you know.
Yeah.
And so you start to see this correlation between faith, and then God rewards that, God blesses that
mm-hmm.
and honors that. But in Matthew, there's a story where the disciples couldn't drive out a demon-possessed man, and they came to Jesus. Jesus drives out the demon, and they asked Jesus afterwards, like, "Hey, why couldn't we do that?" And he
mm-hmm.
said, "Because you had so little faith."
Yeah.
So there's also the opposite cause and effect of when we have a lack of faith, like you're saying, when we're sitting here going, "Oh, poor me," or "God, I don't know if you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wait till this circumstance gets changed, and then I'll live my life." God's not going to bless that.
Yeah.
He's not actually going to bless that. Mm-hmm. So I love it. Oh, Mignon, I could talk to you all day. I told y'all. See you as a firecracker. I just love your story. I love your heart. I love how Jesus just shines through you, through the words that you share, that through the insights that you have. And you are leading this amazing business that people love the cake. Like, you have refined the recipe. See these amazing, really cool recipes. We were talking about, what was it, Jack and Coke.
Yeah.
Jack and Coke cupcakes. Who doesn't want one of those? But I remind women all the time, they think there's this separation between business and the marketplace, a for-profit, you know, secular marketplace business. And their faith. I'm like, no, God is in your business, because God is in you, and you are in your business, and you are such an example of that. Tell people, for anyone in Nashville, New Orleans, where they can find the cupcakes.
So we are at thecupcakecollection.com. We're on Twitter as Cupcake Tweets. We're on Facebook and Instagram as The Cupcake Collection. So those are all the places that they can find me. Or if they just want to talk to Mignon,
there you go.
I'm mignon.francois on Instagram.
Awesome. Thank you so, so much. Thanks so much for watching. And don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. And now you can check out this next video.